Greetings once again to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, to friends, students, and allies scattered across the planet, and anyone else who cares or dares to listen. This is your navigator, John Lash, recording once again on the 10th of November, 2013. This is Nav Briefing number 91, and I'm calling it Navigator and Nahual. Now, if you listen to Nav Briefing 90, you will know that I have resumed the briefings after a considerable lapse of time, about 6 weeks, all through the month of October and now into the month of November. And I still haven't got around to talking about the sacred masculine, but I'm getting there. It's taking a while because, in some measure, I have other things I'd like to cover first. So I might seem to be meandering a bit as I pick up these briefings once again. Also, of course, I'm struggling with that sense of reservation that I described. I would even go further than what I've said so far. I have a certain sense of dread of talking about the sacred masculine. But nevertheless, I'm getting there. I am getting there. So hang on to your underwear. And we'll see when it comes out. Now, before I get into the material of this briefing, I want to make a couple of small corrections. In NB90, I referred to the intrusion of the Archons through Salvationist and Messianic religion. And I said that that happened 2,000 years ago. But it actually happened 4,000 years ago. The initial phase, which was the intrusion into a small Semitic tribe in the Middle East, would correspond to that period of time that historians assign to the prophet Abraham, or the patriarch Abraham. And that is about 1850 BCE. Or 1850 BC. So about 2,000 years before the so-called Christian era, the Archons accomplished an intrusion into the human mind, and they planted their virus. The virus incubated in the Hebrew or Jewish culture for about 2,000 years, and then about 2,000 years ago, 2,000 years back from the present moment, it mutated pandemically into Christianity. I described this development in the first chapters of part one of Not in His Image. Then, around the year 600, it mutated again into the virus of Islam. So all these three religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, have the same root. They are called the Abrahamic religions because they all recognize the same patriarchal figure as their origin. And all these three religions carry the Archontic virus as a belief system, as a salvationist and messianic ideology, tremendously destructive to human life on earth. The second aspect of Archontic intrusion concerns AI, artificial intelligence, and HAL, or the technology of simulation. And that intrusion has manifested lavishly and in a spectacular manner in much more recent times. So as I was saying, in NB90, those of my generation have had the opportunity to see this coming on, to see the advent and takeover of an alien operating system in this experiment. Beginning 2,000 years BC and coming up to 2,000 years AD. 4,000 years of very intense archontic attack upon the human species. Finally, I should probably qualify some things that I've said regarding Islam and people who call themselves Muslims. You know, Muslims may have had their humanity destroyed by the archonic virus, but they're no different than Christians and Jews who have likewise had their humanity destroyed. So why would I pick on Muslims in the way that I seem to be doing here? Well, I just want to qualify what I said about Muslims by recalling the topic of rationality. What I observe in the mentality of Muslims is that lack of rationality has reached an extremely flagrant condition. So, since I associate rationality with love, what I'm saying is that any group of people who are incapable of rational discourse, such as Muslims appear to be, as far as I can tell, are going to be incapable of love as well. Now, I have to say that I don't personally know any Muslims. I'd like to know some. I don't have occasion to know any. And I understand that there are certainly Muslims who listen to my briefings. Those who live in the area of the Middle East and Egypt, who are raised and born into Islamic culture and must by obligation adopt that culture. It's come to my understanding recently that some people in that part of the world know about planetary tantra. They know who Gaia Sophia is. They are following the NAB briefings. Imagine that. And I'd like to say something to those people out there, women and men, whoever they are. I wouldn't be surprised if I met you and we hit it off beautifully, as we say in English. I wouldn't be surprised if we really liked each other and had a beautiful connection. But even if that occurred, and I could look into your eyes and hold your hands and be present with you physically in this world, even if a beautiful feeling arose between us, I would have to tell you that you cannot survive in that belief system as a human being. That it will kill your capacity to love. And it will massacre your humanity. And there is no compromise. You cannot continue to hold the beliefs of Islam and adopt your behavior to that ideology and survive as a rational and loving human animal. It's impossible. Of course, that's also true of Christians and Jews, isn't it? equally so. But there's something particularly poignant about the horrific oppression of Islam upon the human animal, especially sexually. I think it's clear to anyone capable of sober and rational perception that no matter what apologies people make for Islam, those who are born into the system, those who convert to it, or those who would wish to legitimate it for reasons of the multicultural agenda and more insidious reasons behind that, nevertheless, it's obvious that Islam perpetuates sexual apartheid, the separation of the sexes. It perpetuates the domination of men in the household, the domination of men in the society, bearded men who speak as authorities in the social order and who assume the theocratic pretense. Islam is a theocracy. Theocracy is a horror upon this earth, no matter how you cut it. Repression of women, veiling of women, genital mutilation of women. Do I have to go on? What is particularly poignant to me about Islam, and this is what I would say to those allies of the goddess Sophia in that world today, is that you are the third mutation of the archonic virus. You are caught with the third mutation of the archonic virus. And that is the mutation of the virus that is the most resistant to healing, just like the superbugs that you find in hospitals now, or just like bacteria in the natural world that become resistant to antibiotics. Islam is strongly resistant in its ideological structure to being deconstructed and defeated. Therefore, Islam is a formidable, as a belief system, an ideology of theocratic male domination, is a formidable presence in the world. And those of you who are born into it and who are forced in some way or other to conform to that belief system are like what used to be called in the days of the Vietnam War, you know, cannon fodder. Cannon fodder is an English term. Cannon means a gun, and fodder is something that you feed to cows or animals. Cannon fodder was a term used to refer to young men in the Vietnam War. I would have been one of those men if I had not escaped the draft. Young men of 17, 18, 19, 20 years old who are just put on the front line and just massacred in a war game that is arranged and orchestrated by the globalist banking mafia and the military-industrial complex. Islamic people who may still have certain real, genuine human qualities of love, compassion, tolerance, and rationality that have nothing to do with Islam are being used as a weapon of multicultural destruction. And what is particularly poignant to me about you in the Islamic world is that you are not only the weapon, for instance, to destroy the nation states of Europe by immigration to Sweden, Denmark, Holland, and other countries, but you yourself are a disposable weapon. It is indeed true that unlimited immigration based on the Zionist policy of multiculturalism, which is a way to use Islam to destroy the goyim, it is true that that system is making vast inroads in Northern Europe, particularly in Sweden, which seems to be on the front line. But I would point out that those members of the Islamic communities, if you will, who are involved in using immigration as a weapon of mass destruction, will themselves be destroyed in the process. So I feel compassion for those in the Islamic world who may have heard of me and the Gaia Sophia mythos and even the planet, the GNE, and who may listen to my briefings. And I stand before you in the spirit of Maitreya, that is, the friend who is a stranger, the friend that you will never meet. And I tell you as a friend that my heart aches for what you face. And I can only wish, I can only hold a desire that your dedication to the beauty and power of the planetary goddess will set you free. Well, I'll leave that on that note for right now. Bear with me as I am still kind of groping around to get my bearings to pick up these NAB briefings. And I'm still facing some matters of which I am reluctant to speak, and some matters of which I can't speak at all. Also, I don't want to bring too much of a heavy-handed or even morbid tone into these briefings right now. That would be extremely unskillful and inappropriate. I think it might be best at this point in this briefing if I hold true to my promise that I am finally going to talk about the sacred masculine. So I'll include some words about that topic in this briefing, and let's see as I do so if I can then bring the language and the message I have for you today around to the title of this briefing, which is Navigator and Nahual. So, to sort of set the atmosphere for the topic of the sacred masculine, I'd like you to listen to this short clip.
We were both concerned about not only the Boston bombings, but anti-terrorism or terrorism in general. And he asked me if I had any opinions on this. And I said, well, I believe that really FSB and Spetsnaz are some of the world's leading experts on terrorism. And I believe that there's a reason for that. And it's because, you know, from before Beslan, through Beslan up until now, Russia has had to deal with some of the most horrific acts of terrorism in the history of mankind.
But what do you think it really says about the nature of relationship between these two countries, the world's greatest powers with some of the largest stocks of nuclear weapons, when even basic communication was impossible without participation of somebody like you, who is not involved in politics? You are not part of the government.
I think that what happened here, as Dana said to me, the last time I asked the CIA to provide me with people and answers, they gave me people and answers that answered my questions the way they wanted it to be answered, meaning the CIA, and the same with the State Department. Dana knew that I knew the right people in Russia, and he knew that I would get them to tell him the truth. And we all feel, Dana and I feel, that Russia and America have never fought each other in a war. We believe that Russia and America should be best friends. And we believe that many of the people in America love Vladimir Putin. We believe that many of the people in America love Russia. We believe that many of the people in America are not going along with the hocus pocus of certain governmental bodies who want to try to perpetuate the Cold War. We believe that the Cold War is a fantasy and a hoax to perpetuate maybe some sort of financial gain here and there for certain individuals. And we think that the only way to really create world balance and world power and peace in the world is if America and Russia become brothers and best friends. And that's my mission in life.
So those are the words of Steven Seagal, who, as you may know, was for a couple of decades or more a well-known actor who portrayed a warrior hero and master of the martial arts in quite a number of films, some of which were really of a crap quality, but a few of which had some nobility and genuine heroic values expressed in them. This is an excerpt from an interview he had posted on November 10th on RT, as you know, Russia Today, and it's called Steven Seagal, Obama Regime Very Good at Controlling Media. So what Steven Seagal is saying here, and let's just for the sake of the argument, consider him to be a symbolic icon of the sacred masculine, or certainly of the warrior and the hero. What he is saying is that the key to world peace is the friendship and cooperation of Russia and the United States. Well, I think it's remarkable that he's saying that, which is exactly what I've been saying for some time now, as you may know. I don't use the word brotherhood, I use the word sisterhood. And I have said that Russia and the United States are twin souls. They are soul sisters. And that the unity and amity and friendship and cooperation of the Russian and the American people would be a tremendous act of alchemy on this planet, a tremendous act of social alchemy. Were such an event to occur through the recognition and friendship of the Russian and American people, irrespective of their government, that would be a massive indication that Sophia's correction is playing out in the collective and global theater of events. So I recommend to you this interview with Steven Seagal, who recently, it appears, intervened in a political bind, in a political deadlock between Russia and the United States. And through the force of his personality and his moral convictions regarding the connection between America and Russia, was able, apparently, to produce some positive results. I would make these two short comments about what he says. Certainly, yes, Russia has faced acts of terrorism that have been of the most gruesome kind known in recent historical memory. This is true, Steven Seagal. But I would point out that the most gruesome of all those acts and the monumental, horrific event that resulted in the democide and genocide of tens of millions of people was the takeover of the Russian Revolution by a gang of Jewish Bolshevik communists. And when is the world going to recognize that that greatest act of terror, which was opposed by Adolf Hitler in his war against the Soviet Union, is the key to understanding what terrorism really is? Whereas the war on terror today is a fraud and a charade, which equally so is manipulated by those very same forces. One proof of this contorted scenario of deceit is that Homeland Security and a great deal, almost all of the measures being fraudulently imposed in the cause of the war on terror upon the American people is a Mossad / Israeli operation. For instance, look at Michael Chertoff, who owns the company that sells the body scanners that are in the airports being used by the TSA. TSA is not a government agency. TSA is not an agency of the American government. It is a private company contracted by the American government. And behind that private company are the same Jewish Zionist global banking and terrorism agencies that we're behind the Russian Revolution, although we're coming forward from the Russian Revolution two or three generations down the road. So it is the Zadig program that generates terrorism in this world. I said that and not in his image. I said that the Zadokite program of the Hebrews in the Old Testament is the seed of global terrorism today. So there's Steven Seagal, and you might say that his appearance in this interview and his intervention in this event represents a concrete case in the world at large of the return of the sacred masculine. Also, the second comment that I want to make is he says that many people in America love Vladimir Putin. Well, I don't know about loving Vladimir Putin. You don't have to love Vladimir Putin to love Russia. Vladimir Putin is an ex-KGB Russian mafioso in his own right, although he is a staunch adversary of the Jewish Russian mafia, which is the most dangerous in the world, and he has been waging a war against them for decades. Nevertheless, let's not be naive here. This is a war of different bands of mafiosi. Following the analogy that Gerald Celente often uses. So, loving Vladimir Putin? No, Steven Seagal, I wouldn't go that far. I can admire Vladimir Putin for making an heroic move in the global political chess game, but I don't have to love him and enshrine him personally as a hero, and I would not recommend anyone to do that. So on that note, let's see if I can segue into my current thoughts regarding the sacred masculine. I had said a while back that the title of NB90 would be The Return of the Sacred Masculine. You'll also recall that I designated the Venus-Saturn conjunction close to the star Cambalia in mid-September to be the omen of the return. Since that time, going on 2 months now, I've been in a continual reflection about the sacred masculine. I've been reflecting on, first of all, what it is in my own life, what it is by way of reflection to my own self, to my character and mission in this world, if you will. And simultaneously, I've been reflecting on what it could be externally in the lives of men today. First of all, that circle of men who have contacted me, those who are in the GNE, the closest circle around me, a few of which I've met personally. I want to say, by the way, that I deeply regret that over the last year and a half, I haven't responded more directly and promptly to those men who have written me about realizing the sacred masculine and the role of the hero. There is a circle of men now who've identified themselves in the GNE and on the boundary of the GNE. The first of those men goes back quite a ways to my American friend and radical ecologist, Bill, who's a devotee of Emily Dickinson, by the way, as I was for many years. And starting with Bill Johnson and coming ahead to other people, other men who've contacted me from Germany, from Sweden, the UK, Wales, South America, there is a circle of men forming. There is a constellation of heroes emerging around the GNE and the Sophianic vision story. And I deeply regret that I have not been able to enter into a more direct and lively communication with these men. I have not even been able to organize the circle of men so that they are in contact with each other. I regret that. I would have loved to do that. I simply can't do it. I have not done it because I can't. I can't organize much of anything, to tell you the truth, except the GNE process itself. It takes all of my powers to do that, and as I said, I'm booked. I don't like to be booked. I wish that I could find a way to have a dialogue and an organization of the heroic men who are appearing, but so far I don't know how to do that. So in my reflections about the sacred masculine over the last 2 months, the central theme has been a single seven-letter word. I mentioned in those briefings going back to September that I had a major breakthrough in the summer. This breakthrough enabled me to define the sacred masculine in a way that has not until now ever been done, as far as I know. And that breakthrough consisted, of course, of quite a considerable consolidation of insights. It was, you might say, the final amplification and culmination of an entire lifetime of contemplating the fate of the hero. So when I wrote my book, The Hero, in 1995-96, I didn't know this seven-letter word. Although my book, The Hero, Manhood and Power, probably does contain some viable and trustworthy parameters to define the true hero and the sacred masculine, it does not reach to the core where I arrived at the end of the summer of 2013 and the beginning of the fall. I arrived at the core, what I consider to be the core of the definition of true manhood. And now, still against some serious reservations, I'm going to see if I can tell you what that is. I want you to recall that time last year in the GNE when we were looking closely at events in the constellation of the Bull. And in the context of my exposition regarding Channel 16, I proposed an experiment of group telepathy. And part of that experiment, well, there were three parts to the experiment. There was the call sign for Channel 16. There was a visual image, and then there was a message or a verbal component. So those were the three components that I proposed for this telepathic experiment. And you may recall what that image was. The line drawing or lithograph by Picasso entitled Dance with Banderillas. And it shows a man kneeling, holding the head of a bull severed from its body, and a woman standing in an elegant posture of dance above the man, driving the banderillas into the head of the bull. No matter what you think of Picasso, and no matter what you think of bullfighting, as a work of art, I strongly believe that this image transcends the limitations and flaws of its originator. It is truly, to me, a glorious, iconic image of the triumph over violence that can be achieved by men and women acting heroically together and each assuming their roles. It is an image of the self-mastery of the aggressive tendencies of the human animal and many other things as well. Remember at the time that we associated that image from the Picasso lithograph, with the constellation of the bull, we were observing the transit of the lunar apogee through the bull in combination with its complex and nonlinear tango dance with Jupiter. The transit of Jupiter through the bull marks the second phase of the three phases of the 3 years of the GNE. Okay, all that for review. Now remember that I provided some inceptive syntax at that time, relating it closely to the two horns of the bull. I designated the lower horn of the bull, marked by the star Alheca, in close proximity to the Crab Nebula, as relating to the regenerative, reproductive, and regenerative powers of the goddess. And I associated it also with the episode of the Christos intervention in the Sophianic narrative. Simultaneously, I designated the northern horn of the bull, which is marked by a star that is held in common with the constellation of Auriga, or the charioteer, the star Elnat, with Thelete, and with another current of divine imagination. So I ask you to revisit the image of the bull, one of the most powerful and forceful, graphically speaking, a dynamically forceful graphic image in the sky. It's impossible to look at the bull and contemplate the constellation of the bull with its bright marking star Aldebaran, with the Pleiades on the neck or hump of the bull, without feeling the tremendous momentum and the tremendous dynamic force engraved in this constellation. And that force expels itself, as it were, through these two horns. So the two horns can easily be converted imaginatively into massive currents proceeding from the bull. And as I suggested in that original experiment of last year, these are the masculine and feminine currents of the imagination of the Aeon Sophia herself. They are not currents of human imagination. They are currents of divine imagination. And you will recall that when I introduced this concept of the male and female polarities of divine imagination, I indicated how they operate here on Earth. Divine imagination operates materially on Earth. You would identify it by its material, biological, geophysical, electromagnetic manifestations, by those phenomena. There is a range of phenomena happening on the planet in which you are immersed that exhibits these two polaric currents. Now I would just take you back to that same paradigm and revise the language a little bit. I propose that you associate the southern horn of the bull with the feminine current of divine imagination, as before, and that you give it a single term, which is libido. So one current of the divine imagination of Sophia, of her own epinoia, is her libido. This is not an abstract force, my friends. Look out in the world and you see the libido of the planetary animal mother rampantly operating in every aspect of every phenomenon of nature. You see it, of course, in the massive breeding in what scholars naively and somewhat misleadingly call the fertility of the earth, you know. But the fertility of the earth, I advise you, is evident everywhere. Right now, what's happening in the little house where I live is that acorns are falling on the roof from the Andalusian oaks that overhang the house. If I go outside and look up at these acorn trees, I see that they're massively covered with acorns, which are dropping to the grounds by the hundreds. And every day, as I sit here in the house, and especially in the quiet tranquility, in the deep tranquility of the evening, I have the opportunity for a Zen experience of Satori, or Satori, every time I hear an acorn drop on the tiles of the roof. It makes a kind of metallic ping. In the deep silence of the night, a metallic ping. That's a moment of complete and unconditional enlightenment. A moment that you could not anticipate, but you can only participate. And so, that simple event of acorns falling on the roof of this house is a granular detail of the immense outpouring of the libido of the planetary animal mother. Look at the activities in a tide pool. Look at an anthill. Look at the breeding of the sheep here on the hillside. What scholars, unfortunately, have failed to understand about the so-called fertility of the mother goddess is that it is simply a side effect of her libido, which is her pleasure-seeking function. There are countless millions of acorns on the ground in excess to those that seed and grow into trees. Why is that so? That's not because she simply follows a plan where she overloads her reproductive circuits to ensure survival. No. She overloads her reproductive circuits because her pleasure circuits are already overflowing. So the abundance of nature is a manifestation and side effect of the immensity of her libido. She is in an ecstasy of hedonic and erotic power, and infatuation, in fact, with her own erotic power. She is infatuated with her own erotic power, Gaia Sophia. Well, I can relate to that. And she is deeply, deeply involved in fertility processes, yes. But she's involved in the abundance of fertility in the natural world, in microbial fertility, the fertility of the colonies of butterflies, and the fertility of all of the plants, species, pollinating across the earth. She's involved in that in a kind of a manic frenzy of gambling. Because remember, the Aeons are addicted to gambling, and she's no exception. She likes the low odds. I've said this often, haven't I? She likes the low odds. What is the delight of the Aeon Sophia? It is to cast countless millions of acorns upon the earth and see a few thousands of them sprout and grow into trees. Why is that her delight? Because she likes the low odds. And in order to have the low odds, you have to have a high output with a very small return. That's her pleasure. That is her delight. That is the way she operates. Now, when we turn to the human animal, and we keep in mind the concept of the feminine polarity of Sophia's imagination, which is libido, then we say, well, how does her libido manifest in the human animal? Well, it's the same libido. It's the same Shakti. It's the same Shakti, Bhakti, erotic, hedonic current that you all have operating in yourselves, and that is what makes you pleasure-craving animals. Now, even though you live in a society which represses that pleasure-craving, and this goes back to Freud, and I need to talk about that at some point soon, even though there are many factors in the social order of human experience, many factors in the tonal, which relegate against your hedonic and pleasure-craving capacities, you are nevertheless driven by that same current of aeonic libido. So the manifestations of aeonic libido are hedonism, voluptuary tendencies in the human animal. And prior to the repression of the Judeo-Christian ethic, in the pagan world, those tendencies were recognized and honored and respected and given their proper due. Now let's turn to the other polarity of Sophia's imagination, which represents, let's say, the male polarity. That would be the northern horn with its tip marked by El Nat. This current would be in some way deeply associated with the Aeon Thelete. There are factors of the role played by the Aeon Thelete in correction that remain to be revealed. But I would suggest to you a brilliant insight that was introduced to me by Kundry in one of our legendary conversations, when she said, she asked me, do you think that it's possible that Thelete could occupy the planet Jupiter as an aeon? Isn't that a remarkable question? You know that the archonic planets in the solar system are archonic constructions, and they are inhabited in by the archons, who, as a team of engineers, maintain those planets and maintain and participate in the inorganic conditions of life on those planets. But inorganic life is subject to the power of the archons, to the power of the aeons, as much as organic life is. And any one of the aeons, by intention, could commandeer a planet in the solar system. So it is not beyond the realm of possibility at all that in some respect Thelete is working through the planet Jupiter for the correction of the Aeon Sophia. Isn't that fantastic? And I would add as well that there is already a confirmation of that possibility, you might say, in the proposition I gave you at the beginning of this experiment. The correction of the divine Sophia happens in the apsides of Jupiter. So all along, from the very start, we have observed that Jupiter plays a consummate and outstanding role in Sophia's correction. And therefore, I think that Kundry's suggestion is correct, that there is an intimate connection between Jupiter and Thelete. Now, looking at the male current, we can say it is a thelitic current. It is a thelitic current. Let's call it the thelitic current of the divine imagination of Sophia. Whatever I have said until now about this current, I won't recapitulate. I want to see if I can go directly to the new material. And I guess the way to do that is to give you the seven-letter word, which, it so happens, rhymes with libido. And that word is morbido, M-O-R-B-I-D-O. So let's suppose that complementary to the power of libido in the life of the planet, and in the life of every living creature, including the human animal, complementary to that, there is the power of morbido. What is morbido? That is a seven-letter word that defines the essence of the sacred masculine. How can I tell you what morbido is? This is not easy for me to do. I'll tell you first what morbido isn't. In my initial characterizations of the northern horn and the male current, I believe that I said that you can identify it through its manifestations, which are the predatory drive of the human animal and the predatory drive in the food chain on this planet. This experiment, whether you like it or not, is inserted into a habitat that is run on a food chain and on predation for the purposes of consumption. Now, focus in your mind that when I speak of predation, natural predation, I mean the killing of one animal form by another for the purposes of consuming that animal for the purposes of survival. That is natural predation. Natural predation is the manifestation that you see all through life on this planet that expresses the thaletic current. There is the power to reproduce and regenerate in libido, and there is the tendency and drive to kill in the morbido. The morbido is the drive to kill, but it is not simply the drive to kill in a generic and comprehensive way. It is a very specific strain of the drive to kill. So let's consider again what it isn't. Let's see how I'm doing here. Morbido is not natural predation. Natural predation, which is evident everywhere in the habitat on this planet, is selective predation. I've said this before, that all species are assigned, as it were, by the Aeon Sophia, a narrow range of prey. And I've talked about the prey-predator bond, that the connection between prey and predator in nature is actually a sacred bond. It ought not to be looked upon as some horrific act of violence and murder, because it isn't. This is the way this experiment is set up. So face it the way that it operates. There is a kind of beauty in the kill of the leopard upon the gazelle. And part of the beauty in the leopard's kill is the skill of the leopard and the very low odds that the leopard will succeed. Do you know that a mother leopard or a mother cheetah, say let's take the cheetah, this is, can run at 70 or 80 miles an hour, has only 4 chances to get prey for herself and her offspring. 4 runs. She expends so much vital force and depletes herself so much that after 4 runs, if they are unsuccessful, she may be unable to hunt any further and she will pine away and die. That is very, very low odds. So Phaya assigns very low odds to the predators in relation to their prey. And likewise, an aspect of selective predation is that the leopard, the great predatory cats and so forth, and many other predatory species do not decimate their prey. That would be contradictory to the operations of the food chain. So they eat what they can. They eat what they need to eat, and they leave the rest. As we know, the human animal is the one exception in this scheme of things, in this scheme of survival. First of all, the human animal is not assigned to a specific and limited range of prey. Therefore, human animals prey on all other species. And secondly, the human animal is not designed instinctively with a sense of limit so that it only preys upon another species to the extent that it needs to do so for survival. On the contrary, the human animal preys excessively and wastefully upon other species. The essential approach to Gaian ethics requires that you place yourself as a human animal within the laws of nature to understand what moral activity in the human animal would be, without placing ourselves in the laws of nature, we can never understand how we need to behave for the benefit of this experiment. So I've made that point before. Secondly, there is another kind of drive to kill exhibited all through nature and in the human animal, and that is self-defense. So let's say a coyote normally will prey on certain other creatures in the prairie. It will not attack or kill a human animal unless it does so in self-defense, or unless it is extremely desperate. All creatures will venture to some degree outside the range of their selective prey if they are in a desperate situation and need to eat to live. However, the drive to kill in self-defense is another aspect of the thaletic or male current. Human animals have the drive to kill in self-defense, although due to the horrific deceit of religious conditioning, we have been taught to look upon this as something that is morally unacceptable. So you have pacifism. You have the pathology of pacifism, as Ward Churchill calls it. That is to say that there are people apparently walking around on this earth on two legs, human animals, who would not defend themselves and who would not kill someone else, would rather let themselves be killed. This is a failure of the second aspect of the thaletic drive to kill. It is perfectly legitimate to harm or kill another animal, including another human animal, in defense of one's own life. Now there's a third aspect of the thaletic drive to kill, which is still not yet the morbido, but we're getting there. The third aspect is that a human animal would kill in the defense of others. That's not the same as killing in self-defense. So, to protect the community, to protect those who are unable to defend themselves, and to protect one's family and friends, a human animal can exercise the drive to kill in self-defense. Then there is even a further degree of that drive, which is the drive to kill in defense of an ideal, in defense of something that one believes in. Obviously, that manifestation of the thaletic drive to kill is very, very easily perverted. You see the perversion of that, for instance, in Islam. The religion of Islam is permeated with the call to exercise the drive to kill upon infidels and those who do not accept complete, who do not follow complete submission to Islam. That's an example of the perversion of the thaletic drive to kill at the level where one kills for an ideal or a belief. Very, very dangerous. You can see how dangerous the thaletic current is in its various deviations. When we recognize what the thaletic current is, the first thing that you must do is to recognize it and accept it and own it, that it exists and it is part of the order of the natural world exhibiting itself in human behavior. Then you can look at the perversions and deviations of that current. And this is a most instructive process. So with that much established, now let's cut to the chase. I'm telling you what the morbido is not. It is not the drive to kill in selective predation to consume food. It is not the drive to kill in self-defense of one's own being, in self-defense of one's own body. Nor is it the drive to kill in self-defense or in defense of someone else or of a community. Nor is it the drive to kill in defense of a belief or idea. Then what is it? Morbido is the most refined and exquisite, and I would even say excruciating, thread in the current of the male polarity of divine imagination. And the sacred hero is the man who feels this excruciating current like an arc flame that burns inside his very being. If you imagine an exquisite flame, hot white flame of an arc torch that burns to a very fine needle point. This is the actual feeling of morbido in a man's body, and a woman's as well, because women have morbido as well. But it is more massively distributed and predominantly expressed through the male animal. Morbido is the drive to kill for the pleasure of killing. This actually exists in the human psyche, and I don't think it's any great surprise for me to say that. Although I have to tell you, it's not easy for me to say this. The terrible truth about morbido is that we come to the recognition of it at this moment in Sophia's correction. First and foremost, by seeing its massive deviance and perversion in the world. I don't think anyone can deny that there are male animals on this planet who delight in killing. And this delight in killing, this pleasure in killing, is the indicator of morbido. But depending on how it is expressed, you will see the absolute and horrific perversion of morbido, or you will see its correct, moral, and heroic expression. What the world today shows, what the theater of horrors in this world today show, is the massive perversion of morbido. But unless morbido is recognized for what it is within that perversion, how can it actually be claimed for what it is? How can it actually be claimed and turned to its true, correct expression? I certainly don't associate myself in any way with mercenaries who are operating today in hundreds of countries all around the world and who are indiscriminately killing people. They're not killing in self-defense. They're killing people who do not even defend themselves. They're killing people to enforce an agenda of terrorism, which is orchestrated by other killers at other levels who make phone calls and who manage massive global transactions of funds. They're all men running morbido at its most horrific and perverse frequency. But where are the men who are running morbido for the protection of life? Where are they? You see, the calling to the sacred masculine is not just a calling to some kind of heroic and noble behavior. It is that. It is a calling to stand up for heroic values. It is a calling to defend life and the beauty and power of this divine experiment. But when you really go to the core of it, which is where I've been going for a while, I have to say that you come to one ineluctable proposition. And that proposition depends upon the admission that you want to kill somebody. Not just because you have to, but because you really want to. Now, if someone attacks me in the street, I am obliged to apply Morbido against that animal to defend myself and save my life. But if I simply go out and kill someone who is not directly threatening me, I'm not acting in defense of my own life. I am acting out of pure Morbido. And so the heroic expression of Morbido comes in this way, in the admission of the desire to kill that which harms life, without the requirement of necessity. Without the requirement of necessity. To do it out of pure desire to do it, proactively, and not to exercise the drive to kill simply because a situation requires it. As a matter of fact, in the larger picture, the situation does require it. When you step back and you look at the larger picture, the situation does require that those perpetrators and psychopaths at the global level who are orchestrating the social evils of our times through offices and private, from offices and private planes and making telephone calls, and who never see blood and never touch the dead bodies of the countless victims that they produce, it's necessary to go after them. And this is Morbido. Morbido is what goes after them. Morbido is the power of the sacred masculine that can match the horrific, murderous exertions of patriarchy. And it's the only thing that can match it. So I have to say, in concluding this briefing, that I finally got it out, and I feel okay about it, more or less. I'm glad that I was able to do this, and now I'd like to move on to some other matters which concern me very deeply regarding the completion of the GNE and the completion of matters in the life of the Nahual. I have every intention of completing this experiment down to March and perhaps even into May 2014. I have come to realize, as some of you have as well, that this GNE is absolutely spectacular and a magnificent experiment on this planet. And that it is building into a legacy that we can leave to future generations. I assure you that people in future generations will study the GNE in order to find their own way into the ongoing phases of Sophia's correction. They will go back and look at those people who were there in the core movement at the moment that the initial conditions of that correction were set, and they will see how we struggled with the description, with the syntax, and how we lived these concepts and realizations in flesh and blood to establish a framework for what is to come and to reorient the human race toward sanity. And in doing so, they will see how we had to look into the abyss, as Nietzsche warned, without turning into the abyss, and how we had to look into the face of terror and tear off the masks of terror and come to such realizations as what is morbido. My life right now is a kind of a tightrope act. And I want to again express my gratitude for your patience and sticking with me. I'm at the point of doing one of the most difficult things I've ever done in my life. And that is specifically to implement passage of command. Everything happens at once in the GNE. If it's not overwhelming, you're not in the process. The art of mastering this process is to not to be overwhelmed by being overwhelmed. You see? So, the process is overwhelming, but you can't be overwhelmed by it. And I have been a little bit, well, maybe more than a little bit, over the past couple of months, and that's not all bad. It's also because some fantastically good things are happening. In particular, one fantastically good event. And it can be overwhelmed by the beauty and the good aspects of this experiment in Planetary Tantra as much as by the difficult aspects. So I guess I might conclude this briefing by segueing into the next one. I'll call it Passage of Command. I have to warn you that I have great reservations about talking about Passage of Command, but the time has come to do it. You might reflect on this point, that some of the reservations that I hold toward talking about morbido also apply to talking about passage of command. And why is that? Well, probably you can guess. It's because the subject of death is central to both of those issues. So, how do I talk about that without being heavy-handed? You know, I don't like to be heavy-handed. You know, the Nahual is gay, certainly not in the homosexual sense of that term. But the Nahual is gay, as Nietzsche noted, you know, that the great sages are gay. And W.B. Yeats also noted that. What I would most deeply wish to do as my achievement in the remainder of the GNE is to come through into that gaiety. And that quality of gaiety is a precious, precious element of the human spirit that also belongs to the warrior and all those who would undertake the warrior path.